good evening. Michigan says yes to Biden. Cuomo goes orange and death threats in Michigan. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Monday, November 23rd, 2020. China launched a spacecraft to the moon to gather lunar rocks today. A Long March 5 rocket, part of the Chang'e 5 lunar exploration mission, blasted from its launching pad at the Wenchang Space Launch Site. The probe is named after the ancient Chinese goddess of the moon. On arrival, it aims to deploy a pair of vehicles to the surface. A lander will drill into the ground, then transfer its soil and rock samples to an ascender that will lift off and dock with an orbiting module. If this is successful, the samples will be transferred to a return capsule that will then make the journey back to Earth. It will be the first attempt in decades to bring back samples from the lunar surface. And a little closer to home, Governor Andrew Cuomo announced on Monday that, as expected, parts of Upper Manhattan, Staten Island, and other areas of New York State will go to yellow, orange, and red zones starting this week. Upper Manhattan, which includes Washington Heights and the zip codes 10031, 10032, and 10033, is now, according to state data, in a yellow zone with a 3.3% coronavirus testing positivity rate. Staten Island is now partially a yellow zone and partially an orange zone. The governor speaking earlier today.
Upper Manhattan is going to become a yellow zone. Basically, the Washington Heights area is 3.3. Staten Island, part is a yellow zone, part is an orange zone. You see in Staten Island, Tottenville, 5.89, Great Kills, 5.5, yellow zone, West Brighton, Mariners Cove, Elm Park, etc. Staten Island is a problem. The number of hospitalizations in Staten Island have gone over the last 3 weeks, they've basically tripled, 33 to 91. It's a consequence of action. These are our 3 weeks overall, 122% increase. This is where we wind up, 6,047. At the same rate of increase, if Thanksgiving did nothing, if Christmas season did nothing, if we don't bring down the current rate, we go to 6,000. Staten Island has such an issue that it has triggered a hospital capacity issue. And the hospitals have contacted us, and they say they need emergency beds on Staten Island. And we're going to open an emergency COVID patient facility at South Beach on Staten Island. Remember when we had to set up field hospitals, emergency hospitals for additional capacity? Well, that's what we have to do on Staten Island.
Governor Cuomo. In addition, according to Cuomo, Hampton Bays, Riverhead, Great Neck, Massapequa Park on Long Island are all yellow zones now. Mayor Bill de Blasio added the newly yellow areas of the city may soon turn orange, along with the rest of New York City, as early as next week.
Now a new reality is coming into play. The strong likelihood that in a matter of days, the state of New York will determine that New York City is an orange zone according to state standards. Now, I'm not going to speak for the state or the exact timing. I'm just taking their numbers, looking at them, and acknowledging the clear trajectory and basing it on what the state has said already. There is a likelihood, as soon as next week even, that New York City will be declared an orange zone. Once that happens, we will be in a position to take additional measures to reopen schools. And there's a clear protocol for that. It involves a lot more testing. It's a very conservative, cautious approach. Again, a lot more work. But we will go through that hard work together. I know how much parents want their kids back in school. I know how much educators and staff want to be there to serve kids. It will take a lot more testing, a very aggressive approach, a very proactive approach, but we can do it. If you're a parent, you want your kid back in school as soon as they reopen, get that test consent form in, because that will be absolutely required for any child to come into the school to have a test consent form on file. And that includes all those who opted back into blended learning over the last few weeks.
Mayor Bill de Blasio, the orange zone designation means schools, indoor dining, salons, and gyms would all close. There would also be capacity limits inside houses of worship. And as the coronavirus continues to disrupt the holiday season, there may be some good news on the horizon. Pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca says late-stage trials showed its coronavirus vaccine was up to 90% effective, giving public health officials hope they may soon have access to a vaccine that is cheaper and easier to distribute than some of its rivals. The U.S. is now averaging more than 1,500 new deaths per day, according to data from Johns Hopkins University. The seven-day rolling average for deaths was less than 1,000 2 weeks ago and is now 1,510. There have been close to 1.4 million confirmed deaths globally, and the U.S. has seen the most by far, almost 257,000. Dr. Anthony Fauci explains the breadth of the coronavirus spread in an interview with the Washington Post.
The entire map of the country is lighting up with the dark colors, which indicate increased test positivity, and the slope is like that, which means that if, in fact, you're in a situation when you do the things that are increasing the risk, the travel, the congregate setting, not wearing masks, the chances are that you will see a surge superimposed upon a surge. And you're not going to see the results of that because things lag by a couple of weeks. So what we're seeing now is what happened 2+ weeks ago. What we're doing now is going to be reflected 2-3 weeks from now. So what we want to make sure we don't do is, as we enter into the more risky part of the year, weather gets colder, more people stay indoor, that you don't exactly exacerbate the problem that already exists. And the reason I think it's important, doubly sure of that, is that help is on the way. We have at least 2 highly efficacious vaccines that would likely start be given to people at the highest risk and the highest priority towards the middle and end of December. It should be, in my mind, an incentive for people, despite the fact that we all have COVID fatigue, an incentive to double down and be even more conscientious about the public health measures that I've asked. Because if help is on the way, you want to hang in there, not get infected, not infect your loved ones.
Dr. Anthony Fauci, with COVID cases rising again in New York, nurses in one of the early coronavirus hotspots say conditions at their hospital are unsafe, and they're threatening a 2-day strike on December 1st. Andrea Sears reports.
Nurses at Montefiore Hospital in New Rochelle have been negotiating for a contract for more than 2 years. At a rally outside the hospital on Thursday, nurses said they want wages that are up to regional standards and to hire more nurses to ensure adequate staffing levels, including in intensive care. Michelle Gonzalez, a nurse on the negotiating team, says it takes 4 months to train an ICU nurse, but hospital management only wants to train helpers.
We are not asking for helpers. We have very clearly demanded that we need staff that is ICU trained and ICU prepared. Because if not, these patients are getting sub-level care.
The hospital says it has offered raises of more than 7%. The union representing the nurses notes the COVID infection rate for staff at Montefiore in New Rochelle was triple the average at other New York City area facilities. And Gonzalez says now there are pressures to cut costs in ways that could threaten public health.
Our biggest fear right now is that over on the Moses side where I work, we're already hearing the murmurings from management saying that they want us to reuse PPE.
She adds that reusing single-use personal protective equipment puts nurses and patients at risk of a variety of infections, including COVID. As the coronavirus surges again, Gonzalez points out that healthcare workers are still feeling the traumatic effects of the first wave. She says they need hospitals to recognize the sacrifices they make every day.
We have hit a point where the disrespect has gotten so bad where nurses have no choice. The nurses are talking, the nurses are organizing, and the nurses are going to fight back.
I'm Andrea Sears.
And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Michigan election officials on Monday certified Democrat Joe Biden's 154,000 vote victory in the state. It's another setback for President Donald Trump in his futile attempt to undermine the results of the November 3rd election through baseless legal challenges and unsupported claims of fraud.
Hey, is there any further discussion? Okay, I'm watching Norm, sorry. Is there any further discussion on the motion? If there is no further discussion on the motion from the board members, Melissa, will you please take a roll call vote? Chair Bradshaw?
Yes.
Vice Chair Van Langveld?
Yes.
Ms. Matuszak?
Yes.
Mr. Schenkel?
I'm staying.
Madam Chair, you have three aye votes. One abstention.
The motion does move.
Republicans and Democrats both told of violent threats as they deliberated the outcome of the election.
I don't know about my Democrat colleagues, but I know Aaron and I have received quite a few comments, outright threats, nasty emails, telling me my family's at risk. I had one person even suggest, Schenkel, you got to vote yes to certify for the safety of your family. So we've been through that. And I think you and Mr. Hartman went through the same type of thing. Tell us about what you went through.
Lots of public comment with harsh words. There was a state rep-elect who brought up my daughter and on public comment listed what town I live in and what school my daughter goes to. I have received text messages with graphic photos of naked dead women and then a photo of my daughter letting me know that that's what's going to happen to my daughter, calling me a terrorist and saying that my entire family should be fearful for their lives.
Okay. It sounds a little more graphic than I was prepared to go. I wasn't that graphic. No one sent me pictures of my family.
And the State Board of Canvassers in Michigan has two Republicans and two Democrats. It confirmed the results on a 3-0 vote with one abstention. Michigan's Board of State Canvassers certified the results despite calls by Trump and allies to the GOP members to block the vote to allow for an audit of ballots in Wayne County. That's where Trump has claimed without evidence that he was the victim of fraud. Biden crushed the president by more than 330 votes there. It is the county that encompasses the city of Detroit. And President-elect Joe Biden is set to formally introduce his national security team to the nation on Tuesday, building out a team of Obama administration alumni that signals a shift away from the Trump administration's America First policies and a return to a U.S. engagement on the global stage. The president-elect mentioned his fight with the Trump administration to get his transition started.
Are you kidding me?
Why did you go with national security first?
Because it's national security.
Biden will nominate his longtime advisor, Antony Blinken, to be Secretary of State, lawyer Alejandro Mayorkas to be Homeland Security Secretary, and Linda Thomas-Greenfield to be Ambassador to the United Nations. Avril Haines, a former Deputy Director of the CIA, will be nominated as Director of National Intelligence, the first woman to hold that post. But although the new appointments are a breath of fresh air compared to Trump, progressives may have to be satisfied with a return to the unhappy normal under President Barack Obama. The author of the blog, Tikkun Olam, is Richard Silverstein. He says Palestinians will be among those with little to praise in Biden's appointments.
He really is a captive of the Israel lobby, espouses views claiming that BDS is anti-Semitic, and rejecting Bernie Sanders' position in the primaries that aid to Israel by the U.S. should be conditioned on Israeli settlement freeze, not violating international law. We're going to have an Israel policy that is going to be very weak and very disappointing for the Palestinians and very positive and optimistic for the Israeli far right and the settler movement.
What is that going to mean for the Palestinians in particular in Gaza and the West Bank?
He has said he will not remove the embassy back from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv. There are a few sort of minor things that he can do that would be somewhat positive. He can resume aid to the Palestinian Authority, humanitarian aid that Congress has passed. He can reopen the D.C. consulate for Palestine that was open under the Obama administration. He can reopen a consulate in East Jerusalem that would deal with Palestinian affairs. But those are really palliatives. Those are not fundamental altering of the status quo, and that's not going to happen because Blinken has a huge agenda on his plate. He's got to rebuild and revitalize the State Department, which has been hollowed out under Trump, and he's got to worry about some really big issues like China and Iran.
Israel seems to be quite bellicose towards Iran, and I'm not sure who's been pushing it, Trump or Netanyahu. But both are pushing each other towards a conflict with Iran. And how do you think that's going to go?
Something really important that happened yesterday was that Netanyahu secretly went to Saudi Arabia to visit with Mike Pompeo and the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, first time an Israeli prime minister has ever been to Saudi Arabia. And they were plotting against Biden policy on Iran, against the U.S. Resuming the JCPOA nuclear deal and continuing to make things really difficult for Iran. They want to box Joe Biden in, so he has very few options on Iran. And Biden has already said he wants to rejoin JCPOA. And if he did, that would be a good thing because the Iranians have said they're willing to join and come back into JCPOA as well. But there's going to be a furious backlash by the Israel lobby in Washington and by the Israeli government, as you mentioned. So it's really unclear.
What do they want from Iran? What more can they give them?
What they really want is unstated most of the time, and that's regime change. They want to get rid of the clerical regime, the Islamic Republic, and they want to replace it with a government that would be more appealing to Israel, more acquiescent to Israeli interests in the region and Saudi interests in the region.
Like the Shah.
They want somebody like the Shah, and there have been rumblings in the Iranian community. They're monarchists as well, or they want the MEK, Mujahideen al-Khalq, which is the terror cult that's tried to topple the Iranian government in the 1979 after the Shah was deposed. That's what they want. And if they can't get that, they want to basically bring Iran to its knees. They want to cut it off completely from the rest of the world. They want to make it so that no exports, no oil, nothing can be exported, and there'll be no currency that will be available to engage in any sort of international trade. They want to turn Iran into a basket case, essentially.
What's dangerous about that?
Anybody can throw a match into a barrel of oil and cause an explosion. So that's really what we're talking about. If the U.S. assassinated Qasem Soleimani, who was the director, the leader of their main military force, the Iranian military force, the IRG, and that was an outrageous act on the part of the U.S., a violation of international law, and it could have led to Iran retaliating, which it hasn't done in any serious way, and we could have a wide military conflict in the Middle East, and Israel has over 200 nuclear warheads, let's not forget. If Israel felt threatened by any sort of attack, it could use these nuclear warheads, and it's contemplated doing that in the past. So we have a very, very dangerous situation here in the Middle East. Biden could be constructive on the Iran issue, but not on the issue of Palestine.
Richard Silverstein is the author of the blog Tikkun Olam. But politics professor Stephen Zunes at San Francisco University adds the appointment of Tony Blinken may offer some respite from Trump's America First isolationism.
Blinken is an internationalist. He is more in the old school of U.S. foreign policy and realizing that in asserting U.S. Power around the world, it helps to work with allies and with international organizations. At the same time, he is a real disappointment to a lot of people in the more progressive wing of the party for his support for the Iraq war and his support for Netanyahu in Israel.
What is the changes that we should expect?
We should see an attempt at renegotiating the Iran nuclear deal. We could see a somewhat, albeit still selective, encouragement of international human rights standards, even including a willingness to challenge various Arab dictatorships that the Trump administration has cozied up to. At the same time, we're going to see probably a more hostile view towards Russia and a very critical, though somewhat smarter, I would argue, policy towards China.
Biden, in many ways, won't be as different as we think he is in certain specific policies in the Middle East and others.
Well, a lot of the negative feelings that people feel towards this nomination are tied to Blinken's role as the head Democratic staffer in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee under Biden, where they basically stack the hearings around the Iraq war resolution to only allow for a day and a half of hearings, and they pretty much called almost exclusively supporters of the war, bypassing a lot of scholars and even former UN weapons inspectors like Scott Ritter from testifying that an invasion of Iraq would be illegal, unnecessary, and utterly disastrous. At the same time, some hope that both Biden and Blinken have learned from that mistake, may be less prone to supporting intervention. And indeed, they seem to have shifted towards a more critical view about America's autocratic allies. He takes a very hard line of view against the Palestinians. At least there will resume communications with the Palestine Authority, a resumption of some humanitarian assistance that the Trump administration has cut back. But unfortunately, he'll still continue the line that the supporting the Israeli government and indeed, unlike the Obama administration, keeping criticisms of Israel private.
What do you think would happen as far as the decision to make Jerusalem the capital and to recognize these West Bank settlements? Do you think they'll backpedal on any of that?
Biden was actually the co-sponsor of the Senate bill in 1995 that made it possible for Trump to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem and recognize it solely as Israel's capital. Biden has made clear that he will not reverse that.
What might have been taken by progressive activists, Biden administration policies as a continuation of hated neoliberal policies now looks good after 4 years of a neo-fascist.
Very much so. I think in many ways we are returning to a status quo ante. For those of us who would like to see foreign policy more consistent with human rights and international law, that is certainly a disappointment. At the same time, the new administration will try to engage other countries, will try to listen to diverse opinions, will be far less impulsive in its actions, will take climate change seriously. Despite some progressive concerns about Blinken, he did serious outreach to the activist community during the campaign. He was the one on Biden's foreign policy team that met with people like Matt Duss, who was human rights anti-war activist who served as Bernie Sanders' chief foreign policy guy. So at least it appears that there's going to be openness for dialogue, which was something that, of course, was completely impossible under Trump.
Politics professor Stephen Zunis at San Francisco University. And finally, yesterday was the 57th anniversary of the assassination of the 35th president, John F. Kennedy. Kennedy was shot in Dealey Plaza in Dallas, Texas, while on a political visit. The alleged shooter or sniper, Lee Harvey Oswald, was himself shot to death in the Dallas police station by a strip club owner named Jack Ruby, short for Rubenstein, a few days later. In a phone call between the new president, Lyndon Johnson, and FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, LBJ asked if there were any connections between Ruby, Rubenstein, and Oswald.
This angle in Mexico is giving us a great deal of trouble because the stories I have, this man, Oswald, getting $6,500 from the Cuban embassy and then coming back to this country with it. We're not able to prove that fact. The information was that he was there on the 18th of September in Mexico City, and we are able to prove conclusively he was in New Orleans that day. Now then they changed the date. The story came in changing the date to the 28th of September, and he was in Mexico City on the 28th. Now the Mexican police have again arrested this woman, Duran, who's a member of the Cuban embassy, and will hold her for 2 or 3 more days. And we've got to confront her with the original informant who saw the money pass, so he says, and we're also going to put the lie detector test on him. This fellow, Rubenstein down there, he has offered to take the lie detector test, but his lawyer's got to be cross-consulted first, and I doubt whether the lawyer will allow him. He's one of these criminal lawyers from the West Coast, and somewhat like an Edward Bennett Williams type, and almost as much of a shyster.
Any relationship between the two here?
Between Rubenstein?
Yeah.
No, at the present time, we have not. There was a story down there that...
Was he ever in his bar and stuff like that?
There was a story that this fellow had been in this nightclub, that he, this strip tease joint that he has, but that has not been able to be confirmed. Now, this fellow Rubenstein is a very shady character, has a bad record, street brawler, fighter, and that sort of thing. And in the place in Dallas, if a fellow came in there and couldn't pay his bill completely, Rubenstein would beat the very devil out of him and throw him out of the place. He was that kind of a fella. He didn't drink, didn't smoke, boasted about that. He is what I would put in the category, one of his egomaniacs. He likes to be in the limelight. He knew all the police in that white light district where the joints are in there. And he also let them come in, see the show, get food, and get liquor, and so forth. That's how I think he got into police headquarters. Because they accepted him as kind of a police character hanging around police headquarters. And for that reason, raised no question. Of course, they never made any moves at the picture show, even when they saw him approaching this fella, and got up right to him and pressed his pistol against Oswald's stomach. Neither of the police officers on either side made any move to push him away or to grab him. It wasn't until after the gun was fired that they then moved. Now, of course, that is not the highest degree of efficiency, let's just say. Secondly, the chief of police admits that he moved him in the morning as a convenience and at the request of the motion picture people who wanted to have daylight. He should have moved him at night, but he didn't. And those derelictions in that phase. But so far as tying Rubenstein and Oswald together, we haven't as yet done so. There have been a number of stories come in. We've tied Oswald into the Civil Liberties Union in New York, membership into that, and of course into this Cuban Fair Play Committee, which was pro-Castro and dominated by communism and financed to some extent by the Castro government.
How many shots were fired?
Three.
Any of them fired at me?
All three at the president, and we have them. Two of the shots fired at the president were splinted, but they had characteristics on them so that our ballistic expert was able to prove that they were fired by this gun.
And those are tapes of the phone call between the new president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, and FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, and others. These tapes and others are part of the collection at the LBJ Library in Austin, Texas.